50 years ago, Gene Roddenberry's visionary television series debuted on NBC. It was not an instant success at all. In fact, it was canceled just 3 years later. But a famously devoted fan base kept the sci-fi epic alive, and it has since spawned numerous hit television spin-offs and over a dozen blockbuster films that have dominated the box office for 35 years. Star Trek lives long and prospers on its 50th anniversary. Up next, Mark Zakri shares some stories with us and memories on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. Mark Zakri is a science fiction author, television writer, screenwriter, has written many major studio works and for the networks as well. He also does his own YouTube channel. We'll talk about that. It's called Mr. Sci-Fi. He's got movies working on constantly called The Space Command. And as you know, Mark, of course, he's been on our program to talk about The Twilight Zone Companion as well. And here he is on Coast to Coast, Mark Zakri. Mark, welcome back.
Great to be here, George.
This is an exciting time. 50 years of Star Trek. 50
incredible.
Years.
Yeah, incredible. And it's amazing that so many wonderful Star Trek stories have been created by so many people over all these decades. And I'm sure we're going to be talking a lot about it.
We sure are. What's new with you? Give us some updates.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I have my own studio. I'm shooting Space Command and doing tons of stuff. We've shot the two-hour pilot. We shot 30 minutes of the second two-hour story. We're now meeting with the networks both here and in England. We're going to set it up as a show. It's going to be something that everyone's going to be able to see and enjoy. It's terrific. And I'm doing books, of course. As you said, the new Twilight Zone Companion. And I'm pitching a trilogy of novels and just on and on. Tons of stuff.
You're happy with all this. Life is good for you.
Oh, my God, yes. It's so fun. Because when I realized that my audience could basically greenlight me thanks to the new models, that's when I shot Space Command. My audience greenlit me. They financed me. And now we can go to the networks having shot, you know, the 2 hours and say, this is what we have in mind. So the next step is the network says, okay, we greenlight a season. And that's very different from the way it used to be. So I'm thrilled.
That would be exciting. Well, hey, you know what? Nobody deserves it more than you, Mark.
Thanks, George.
All right, let's talk a little bit about the 50th anniversary of Star Trek.
Okay, yes.
Let's go back a little bit, because you've done some work on Star Trek, too, haven't you?
Yeah. I wrote for both Star Trek The Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, and then I did a Star Trek episode with George Takei that got nominated for the Hugo and Nebula Awards. And Star Trek's been a part of my life ever since I was a little kid. It first debuted back in, as you know, 1966, and before it even aired, NBC commissioned a piece of artwork by an artist named James Bama, and they would run it for 10 seconds as just a still illustration saying, coming in the fall, Star Trek, and I would see this planet and this rocket ship blazing around this spaceship, blazing around this planet, and two guys, and it went by so quickly. This is before video recorders, and so I'd watch this thing. I'd sit right up against the screen waiting for this commercial, and it's like, that guy in the background, does he have pointed ears? What on earth is that? And I couldn't wait to see the show, and then the first episode aired, and it was an episode called The Man Trap, written by my dear friend George Clayton Johnson, and he had been a Twilight Zone writer. He wrote Kick the Can and Nothing in the Dark, a wonderful writer. And it was an amazing episode, and from then on I was hooked. It was just, that was really it for me.
Did you ever think that you'd be doing some work on it?
Well, you know, it's funny. When I was a kid, a book came out called The Making of Star Trek, and this is when the show was on the air. It was written by Stephen Whitfield and Gene Roddenberry, and it was the first book I ever read about how a TV show was made, and that really planted the seed where I started thinking, well, you know, I'd like to be a writer, producer in television, and that kind of set me on that path, and so my dream was to create and run my own space-going science fiction show, and now with Space Command, that's exactly what I'm doing, and so it's just a dream come true, but it was very much set in motion by what Gene Roddenberry created back then.
And it only lasted 3 seasons?
Yeah, and it's funny because, you know, they were actually going to cancel it the second season, and a woman named Bijo Trimble started a letter-writing campaign and a picketing campaign, and I was part of that as a kid. I remember holding my little picket sign, standing outside with a crowd outside NBC, and writing my little letter. A million letters were sent to NBC, and that convinced them to renew the show, and it got its third season. And if not for that third season, it never would have gone into syndication. It wouldn't have had enough episodes, and no one would have ever heard of it again. And in fact, when Star Trek initially aired, I was so worried it would never air again that I actually recorded it on reel-to-reel audio tape as a kid, just in case those episodes never aired anywhere.
I used to love those machines.
Yeah.
Why didn't it succeed in the ratings, Mark?
Well, you know, the funny thing is back then, the Nielsen ratings just registered bulk numbers, how many millions of people were watching an episode. The year after Star Trek went off the air, they switched over to something called demographics, where they would check not only how many people were watching it, but what group of people were watching it.
And age,
right.
Yeah.
And the 18 to 35 demographic was the perfect buying demographic. And the year after Star Trek went off the air, they ran the demographics, and the top-rated show, the number one show for that 18 to 35 demographic that they all wanted was Star Trek.
Oh, my God. Did they freak out?
Yes, because if they had demographics the year earlier, they never would have canceled Star Trek.
Oh my gosh, they would have made money on that show.
That's right. Another funny thing about Star Trek was it was incredibly colorful. You know, with those beautiful red and gold and blue uniforms and the very colorful Enterprise bridge. Well, the network that aired Star Trek was NBC, and its parent company was RCA Televisions, and so they wanted to sell color TVs. And one of the reasons they greenlit Star Trek was because of those bright primary colors, because people would buy color TVs just to see Star Trek. And they actually ran RCA color TV advertisements for Star Trek, so on showing them on color TVs, and they ran them in all the national magazines. I have some of those ads that I've saved since then.
We've had on the program here William Shatner. You brought us George Takei.
Yes.
And I think that was it, just those two.
Yeah. Well, they're great. I mean, they're unforgettable. They're distinctive actors and wonderful. And again, that speaks to the diversity of Star Trek. Because again, when Star Trek debuted in 1966, you didn't have African American actors in the lead like Nichelle Nichols, or Asian American actors in the lead like George Takei. These were characters who were dynamic. They were going on adventures. They were treated with respect by Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock and Dr. McCoy. It was like a surrogate family of people all getting along, all reaching out across boundaries of race and ethnicity to each other. And when you think about it, Star Trek aired during the 1960s. This was the height of the civil rights era. It was the Vietnam War was going on. The moon landings were happening. I mean, it was an incredibly politically active time, filled with political and social turmoil and upheaval and change. It was just the perfect time for that show to debut.
What a tragedy a few months ago when Anton Yelchin, the Star Trek actor, died in that freak accident.
Yes.
When his Jeep rolled down and crushed him.
I know, crazy. And
and yet,
at least he worked in a medium where we get to see his work and enjoy it. And he was a wonderful actor. And again, these Star Trek characters and these Star Trek actors are so distinctive and so memorable. And the fact that Walter Koenig could pass the torch to Anton Yelchin and he could do, Chekhov so memorably, he'll definitely be remembered.
I think we had Walter on, too.
Yes, and he's another very distinctive guy and a wonderful actor. And again, each Star Trek character is so distinctive. And when I wrote World Enough in Time, it was Kirk, Spock, McCoy, Sulu, all of those characters, and they all speak differently from each other. They all have different viewpoints. A Spock line will not work for Kirk, will not work for McCoy,
no.
And vice versa. They all are very distinctive.
They're all for themselves.
And that's why they've lasted.
And didn't we have James Doohan's ashes sent off into space?
Yeah, well, Roddenberry's were too. I went to Majel Barrett Roddenberry's house when I recorded her for the computer voice in World Enough in Time, and Roddenberry's ashes were there. They'd been sent up in the space shuttle and then brought back, and so a very fitting testament.
So, again, what was it like being on that Star Trek set when you were a kid?
Well, you know, I was given a Christmas present of a trip to the Star Trek set when I was a kid. The greatest Christmas present ever. And it was the last episode of the original Star Trek ever shot. If I'd gone a week later, that show would have been gone. And it was an episode called Turnabout Intruder, in which Kirk's personality is swapped with a woman scientist. And it was William Shatner there that day, and Majel Barrett, who played Nurse Chapel, and DeForest Kelly, who played Dr. McCoy. And it was amazing walking those sets. They were so phenomenal, and it was fascinating because one of the stagehands said last show of the season, and under her breath, Majel Barrett said last show ever. And the irony was that decades later, I recorded her as the computer voice for the Star Trek episode I did 30 years later. And so she was not only wrong about last show ever on Star Trek, she was wrong that even herself, because she would continue on Star Trek in later incarnations on Star Trek The Next Generation and then the features and so forth. So just phenomenal.
You and George went to Japan at a convention, didn't you?
We did, yes. Well, when we did World Enough in Time, and that's the episode I did with him, and you can actually watch it on my website, markzickrey.com, in its entirety. And after we shot that episode, we went to the World Science Fiction Convention in Japan. We screened it to an audience of 3,000 people. We got a standing ovation with the crowd with with tears streaming down their faces. And then the next year we were nominated for the top award in science fiction, the Hugo Award, which is given out at the World Science Fiction Convention. So it was just an amazing honor. And to be there in Japan with George, he's fluent in Japanese, and so we were answering questions. I would be fielding the questions in English, and he would be answering in Japanese. And I just saw him the other day. There was a big Star Trek convention in Las Vegas to celebrate the 50th anniversary.
Yeah.
I went to it, and George and I were able to reconnect, and I very much want him in
That's
Space
cool.
Command, so we've been talking about a role he'll be playing in Space Command.
Was Shatner there?
Yes, Shatner was there, and it's amazing because he's 85 years old, and you could never tell. He has the
He doesn't look that old.
Not at all. And his energy level, he seems like a much younger man. He's phenomenal, as is George Takei. George doesn't seem like a guy pushing 80 either. These are amazingly vital and vibrant people and phenomenal actors.
And, you know, Star Trek just wouldn't have been the same without that group.
No.
It was a very special group.
It was lightning in a bottle. You know, it's amazing because, Twilight Zone ended in 1964, and then two years later, Star Trek debuted. And Gene Roddenberry was very much a friend and a protege of Rod Serling's. In fact, he gave the eulogy at Rod's funeral, and Roddenberry was very aware of, if not for Twilight Zone, you couldn't have had Star Trek. And he cast, it's funny because the first pilot, he did a pilot for Star Trek called The Cage that was actually shot in 1964, and it starred Jeffrey Hunter as Captain Pike, and it didn't sell the show. And so they ordered a second pilot, and that's when they got Shatner. And the chemistry between William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy and DeForest Kelly and the rest of the cast, it just was magical. And you could see it from the beginning, from that first episode that aired. You just knew that these people were unforgettable, and they've stayed unforgettable all these decades, 50 years, as you said.
Mark, I also had on, not the originals, but I had Jolene Blaylock on and Natalia Noglic on.
Yes.
Both of them, great, great folks, by the way.
You know, what's really fascinating, again, is that Roddenberry, you know, when he came up with Star Trek The Next Generation, he showed that it was the universe he'd created, and you could have other actors, and it would continue to be successful. And now with the new Star Trek movies and the new Star Trek series that's coming down the pike, it's really got legs, and it's such an amazing universe to play in. I mean, having come up with stories for Captain Picard and for Quark and all these other characters, I can speak to just how vibrant all these characters are and how wonderful these actors are. And again, I'm working with them both in the Star Trek universe and in Space Command. Robert Picardo and a number of the Star Trek actors I'm continuing to work with, just because these are phenomenally talented people. And when you meet them, you just say, gosh, I don't want it to end. I just want to keep working with these guys.
How would you compare the Star Trek series to the Star Wars filming?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. They're very, very different. I think, you know, personally, I as much as I like Star Wars, I much prefer Star Trek, and I think it's much deeper in its rumination on the real world. I think it's got a lot more profound insight. I think that clearly it's lasted 50 years, so there's a lot to speak to it. But beyond that, you know, I think that because it was started during a time of great turmoil, it wasn't escapism. It was really commenting on the real world in a very meaningful way. And because, again, just with Rod Serling on Twilight Zone, where he went into science fiction to avoid censorship, Roddenberry did the exact same thing with Star Trek. And the other thing that's key is Star Wars is science fantasy. It's set in a galaxy long ago, far, far away. It's not meant to be a future that we're going to aspire to or reach, whereas Star Trek was very much, this is a future that's really something we might someday be able to accomplish. And when you look at cell phones, when you look at all these things in Star Trek that now we have, I mean, I frequently talk about my cell phone as a tricorder because I can, you know, access the World Wide Web. I can watch movies and TV shows on it. It's much more like a tricorder than a communicator because it has all these things it can do that Roddenberry predicted in Star Trek. It's phenomenal.
Where were or are some of the writers of Star Trek today?
Well, you know, these were the greatest writers on television. You know, when I saw the original Star Trek, my heroes were those writers. And Roddenberry was smart enough. He did exactly what Rod Serling had done, which is he reached out to the science fiction writers. And so that first season of Star Trek, you had Harlan Ellison, who wrote City on the Edge of Forever, an amazing piece of work. George Clayton Johnson, you know, who did Logan's Run and Twilight Zone. You had Richard Matheson, who again did I Am Legend, many great pieces of work. On and on, D.C. Fontana, a great writer. David Gerrold, who did Trouble with Tribbles. Now, many of these writers are still with us. DC Fontana, Harlan Ellison, David Gerald. I've just seen them recently, and they're still, in many cases, they're still writing, they're still active. Harlan is an amazing writer, an amazing man, just brilliant. And so I started getting to know these people when I was a teenager because they had started having Star Trek conventions in the 1970s. And as soon as I was old enough to go to these conventions, I would go there and meet these writers. And they were as brilliant in person, as phenomenal in person, as they were, you know, in the work they were doing for television. And in fact, in some cases, I would hire them. For instance, when I was on Sliders, I had David Gerald come in and pitch, and we bought a script from him. So. Because the thing is that they were really looking at the real world, looking at life and saying, how can I tell a story in Star Trek that I've never seen before that will be something that will move an audience, that will change their lives forever? And a great example, I'll give you a great example. There was a story that Harlan Ellison did on Star Trek called The City on the Edge of Forever, a great episode, first season episode. Now, in every TV show ever done before that, the hero saves the girl. It was just what happened in television. And in City on the Edge of Forever, because the time... lines have been changed in order for things to be set aright. The woman that Kirk falls in love with has to die. Kirk not only doesn't save the girl, he basically throws her under a truck, literally. And when I was a kid and saw that episode, I was astonished. And it not only said to me, the world is a much more interesting place and a much more challenging place, because you can have to come to a decision where it's going to hurt you deeply, but you have to do what's right. That was the message of that show. And in that hour, just 1 hour of television changed my life forever. And I realized that as a writer, I could do the same thing, that I could write something directly taken from real life that would move an audience, that would enrich them, that would say something about real life, and that could change them for the better. And it's a huge responsibility and a huge opportunity. And that's what Harlan Ellison taught me, just from that 1 hour of Star Trek.
You're going to get a kick out of this, and you may already know this. In 1953, there was a little television series called Space Command.
Huh, yes.
And guess who was in that? William Shatner.
Wow, yeah.
53!
It was a short-lived science fiction show, and yeah, I've got a kinescope of one of those episodes. Amazing, huh? And what goes around comes around. Phenomenal. But it's just because science fiction gives us such an opportunity, because it's wonderfully, you know, you can really talk about possibility. You can say, this is where we can go. This is what we can create. And, you know, people don't often think about science fiction this way, but, you know, when Martin Luther King said, I have a dream and I see a future where the sons of slaves and the sons of slave owners will sit together at the table, he was telling a science fiction story. He was talking about a future that didn't yet exist but could exist. And in the speaking and telling that science fiction story, he was creating a possibility. And that's exactly what Star Trek did. And in fact, Nichelle Nichols, who played Uhura, was going to quit Star Trek. And Martin Luther King met her and said, you must not quit this show because the role you're playing is so important. You must stay on this show. And that's what she did.
Shatner did a couple Twilight Zones in the 1960 and then 63.
Yes.
He did Nick of Time and Nightmare at 20,000 Feet. But it wasn't until 66 when Star Trek popped up that he hit it big. How did he get that part, Mark?
Well, you know, it's amazing because, you know, he was a wonderful actor. He'd been in Judgment at Nuremberg, in fact, with Spencer Tracy. And he's a very dynamic and a very unusual actor and very handsome. And... as I said, in the first Star Trek pilot, they had Jeffrey Hunter, who was incredibly good-looking, a very good actor, but he somehow was a little colder than Shatner. And when they went back to shoot the second Star Trek pilot, Jeffrey Hunter really didn't want to do the second pilot, so they were casting about for someone else, and William Shatner was available, and he was so dynamic and so intelligent and so charismatic. But they cast him. And the funny thing was, my friend Douglas Hayes, who was one of the great directors of The Twilight Zone, was friends with William Shatner, and he'd always been trying to get him in to do pilots for him, and Shatner always turned them down. So then he sees Star Trek coming on, and he calls Shatner, and he says, what's going on with you being in this Star Trek thing? And Shatner said, oh, it'll never last.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Did they get along, the main characters?
Well, you know, there was a lot of competition between Leonard Nimoy and Shatner, and there was a lot of, because Shatner expected to be the star, and it was like with Man from U.N.C.L.E. with Robert Vaughn and David McCallum, where all of a sudden the second banana becomes a star as well.
That's right.
And so Spock became this huge sex figure and intellectual figure and so forth, and everyone was a buzz about Spock. And Spock almost got cut from the show. The network didn't want him to have the pointed ears. They really were very nervous about him looking so devilish. But then, you know, Roddenberry stuck to his guns with that character. But William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy were very competitive, and Shatner would be cutting Spock's lines and wanting to have more lines than Spock. But ultimately, over the decades, they became very, very good friends. And Shatner wrote a book about, you know, Leonard Nimoy in recent years.
Mark, stay with us. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back and talk more about the 50th anniversary of Star Trek. And then I want to get involved in some of the things you're doing on YouTube. What an amazing way to get information out. Space Command, of course. You're doing another edition on the Twilight Zone Companion. I hear rumors about that. And then the next last hour, we're going to open up the phone lines. We'll be back. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast with Mark Zikri as we talk about Star Trek, the 50th anniversary. We're going to take your calls next hour, things that you can talk with us about, things you have recollected from Star Trek and those kinds of genre films. You went to school with Billy Mumy, right?
Yes, yeah, and I've known Billy actually since I was 7 years old, and we've worked together a number of times on a number of different projects, including Space Command and Babylon 5. So he was, and he's of course one of the great genre actors from Lost in Space on, and Twilight Zone, of course.
When he got it, got in Lost in Space and the Twilight Zone, how did you feel as a kid? Were you envious?
It wasn't so much envious as sort of feeling like, well, there's someone like me in this TV show. And when I got to meet him when I was seven, we traded comic books. One day I was homesick and I just called him. You know, I called the stars of Lost in Space from the phone book, and I got his mom on the phone, and then he got on the phone, and off we went. And so it's really fun having this history with him. But I wasn't so much envious as just thinking he was really cool. And he's incredibly talented, great fun to work with.
When you look at how Star Trek was put together and how it evolved, how do you explain the cult phenomena afterward?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. I think Star Trek was a mixture of different things that really hit the sweet spot for what the fans had been waiting for. I think when you looked at science fiction series prior to Star Trek, Lost in Space wasn't really that good a show. I mean, it had a wonderful cast, it was fun, but it wasn't deep and profound and meaningful. And then Star Trek comes along, and it's got great characters, it's got great escapist fantasy, where thinking of just dreaming of being on the Enterprise and thinking, boy, it'd be fun to be a part of that crew and have those kind of adventures. But then it's also commenting on the world. So it was really this great mixture. And I think what happened was, it's partially the difference between when a show airs on network and when it airs in syndication. Because when it's airing on a network, it's once a week, at least it was back then. When it goes into syndication, it's five days a week. So it's every single day, Monday through Friday, you can be watching Star Trek. And I think being able to see the shows that often, because again, this was before you could record a show. There were no video recorders at that point. And so to watch it, you know, that gave it enough... You're seeing it enough, often enough, where you could really become a huge fan of the show. And then you started having Star Trek conventions in the early 70s, and then the Star Trek fans could get together. Again, this is before the internet. So I think when Star Trek fans started getting together and dressing in those costumes, and also when Star Trek was initially on, there were very few products that were released for Star Trek. But once it went into syndication, they saw what a fan base there was. Then you started getting the toys and the books and all of these different offshoot products. And so you could really live a Star Trek life.
Tell us about Next Generation, because that's the one you did a program for, right?
Yeah, and Deep Space Nine as well. Mm-hmm. Well, the fascinating thing was, as soon as Star Trek went off the air and they started to be a fan base, Paramount started thinking about, well, can we get more juice out of this product? And so initially they were going to bring Star Trek back as a series in the 70s, in 1976. They started developing a show called Star Trek Phase Two, and they got the entire cast, except for Leonard Nimoy, who was on the outs with Roddenberry because he'd been wanting more of a cut of merchandising. So they spent a year developing the show and building sets, and then Star Wars came out, and they made the Star Trek movies instead. And those were successful, Star Trek the Motion Picture, Wrath of Khan, etc. So every year or two, another Star Trek movie would come out, and these were Kirk, Spock, McCoy. But then... Paramount had the idea of, okay, let's see if we can do another Star Trek TV show. But because the movies were Kirk, Spock, McCoy, they had to do something different for the TV show. And Gene Roddenberry had the brilliant idea of doing a completely different cast, setting the show decades later in the chronology, and then he came up with Captain Picard and Data and all these different characters. And the amazing thing was, it was a huge success, and from the beginning, basically, and it showed that you could do a Star Trek show that had totally different characters. And then every few years, they'd come out with a new Star Trek series. So after that came Deep Space Nine, and then Star Trek Voyager, and Enterprise, and so they kept, you know, coming up with more and more characters. And it proved that a very durable franchise. And then, of course, J.J. Abrams did the movies that we've been seeing recently, and now Brian Fuller is going to do a new TV show. So again, you can, but it's always trying to find the story that you haven't seen, the characters you haven't seen, expanding the universe. So when I was coming up with stories for Star Trek The Next Generation and Deep Space Nine and then World Ends in Time, the one I wrote with Michael Reeves, the one with George Takei that we shot, that I directed and produced, it's always like, what story haven't we seen? And what comments deeply on the real world and real life. And the challenge always, of course, is that the more Star Trek stories that are being done, and now there are thousands of them, you have to be very knowledgeable about what they've done and find a way to come up with something fresh. And it's challenging, but it's not impossible. It just takes really digging in and bringing your A-game.
Your Deep Space Nine episode is still being touted as one of the best.
Yeah, Far Beyond the Stars. And the fascinating thing about that was, in that episode, Avery Brooks, who plays Commander Sisko, finds himself back in the 50s as a science fiction writer. And we get to see the science fiction writers of the 1950s, and it was all the actors who played the Deep Space Nine characters in heavy makeup. You get to see what they really look like when they're out of that makeup. It was great fun, and what the inspiration was that when I was a teenager, I met one of the writers from the original Star Trek, a great writer named Theodore Sturgeon, and he became one of my mentors. And he had written for those magazines, Galaxy and Astounding and Amazing Stories, back in the 50s, and I realized that if not for those writers who wrote for science fiction magazines for the love of it, before there was a Star Trek or a Star Wars, they were writing for a penny a word, 5 cents a word. They weren't getting rich, but because they loved it, they were creating these amazing universes that led to Star Trek and Star Wars. And I wanted to pay tribute to that era and those writers and talk about why we write science fiction and how it can have a profound meaning if you're writing the truth of your life and using science fiction to show a possible future. And so that's what I was writing about in that episode.
Mark, we're going to take calls with you next hour, but in the time we've got left this hour, let's talk a little bit about some of the other things you've been working on. So tell me about this new edition of the Twilight Zone Companion.
Well, you know, my publisher and I have been talking about it, and now with e-books, you can have links to audio and video and things that used to only be available in university archives are now on the internet. You can just click through and watch incredible rarities, Rod Serling, you know, lectures and commercials and all sorts of stuff. And so I wanted to have access to that material. And also, so I've basically written a new edition. It has over 100 pages of new text. It has hundreds of new photographs. It's got links to audio and video. We're just finishing it up now. It'll be out very, very soon. And it's going to be terrific. It'll include photos. When I finished The Twilight Zone Companion back in the 80s, we had a Twilight Zone party, and the actors and the producers and the directors and Carol Serling, they all came to the. In fact, George Takei was there, and these photographs are full in color, and they've never been printed. And we'll have that stuff too. So it's going to be great, great fun.
I interviewed a writer of a book called Dr. Feelgood. It was about a doctor who would inject a sort of methamphetamine into John F. Kennedy and Jackie and so many other Hollywood stars. And this guy said Rod Serling was on that list.
Really? That's interesting. Well, I hadn't heard that, but Rod certainly drove himself hard, you know, and back then people didn't know the dangers of amphetamines as we do now.
They were legal.
Right, exactly. And but I mean, you know, those guys were that was the Hemingway generation. They worked hard, they drank hard, they smoked hard. That was what a man's man was. And you know, Serling was a soldier in World War II. I mean, he really, nowadays they would have said he had PTSD coming out of the war, but he used writing to work that out.
To work that out. That's right.
Exactly. Exactly.
Good point. But
amazing, amazing men, and they created work that's lasted till now. Phenomenal guy.
About what, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, you opened up the sci-fi YouTube channel, Mr. Sci-Fi?
I was having lunch with Glenn Mazzaro, who was the showrunner of The Walking Dead, and he said, he's a good friend, and he said, you know, you're so knowledgeable about science fiction, why don't you start your own YouTube channel where you can just talk about science fiction movies and TV and books? Because I know so many stories that all these dear friends have told me that have never been published. Ray Bradbury was my mentor for over 10 years, as you know, And so I thought, well, that'd be great. So I started my own YouTube channel. It's called Mr. Sci-Fi. And it's funny because there was a great icon of science fiction named Forrest J. Ackerman, and he coined the term sci-fi, and he was known as Mr. Sci-Fi, and he was another friend of mine. And so I called it Mr. Sci-Fi as a tip of the hat to him. And he died a few years ago. Amazing man. And so every week or so, I'll post a video about talking about whatever I want to talk about, whether it's Star Wars or Star Trek or, you know, Rod Serling. One of the videos I did was telling the story of how Rod Serling and Ray Bradbury, how their friendship fell apart over Twilight Zone. And so basically, because Ray told me that story after many years, he never talked about it publicly, nor did Rod. And so finally, Ray told me the story, and I thought, now I can pass it on. It's an amazing story. And so Mr. Sci-Fi is just my little playground where I can talk about anything I want to.
Isn't technology amazing to allow people like you, like me, like anybody, to do this?
Yes, it's great. Well, it's so funny because I'm doing Space Command, which is this huge, epic science fiction story that has, you know, thousands of visual effects and all of that. It's this monstrous, big project, and yet Mr. Sci-Fi allows me just to, you know, take my iPhone, turn it on myself, and talk for 5 or 10 or 20 minutes, and then just put it up on the internet. So I like the fact that I'm working on something that's very challenging, like Space Command, but very rewarding, but also Mr. Sci-Fi, which is very, very fun. So it's great to be able to do the whole gamut of things.
Let's talk about Space Command, and how many episodes have you done, or you've just done the pilot?
I've written the first 8 hours, and I've outlined hours 9 through 12, so that's the entire first season. We shot the first 2 hours. We're in post-production on that. We just debuted the opening 5 minutes at Comic-Con.
Is Neil still with you?
Neil has been advising and talking with us, but he's gone on to other features. But a lot of actors I've worked with, like Doug Jones and Robert Picardo and Bill Mumy and Mira Furlan from Babylon 5 and even Mike Harney from Orange is the New Black are aboard on the project. And so we've just been, you know, having an amazing time doing it. And now we're going to the network. So I basically brought CAA aboard as my agency, and now we're laying out the whole strategy. I was in London. Frank Spotnitz, who runs Man in the High Castle, an amazing show, he's been advising me, and he said, go to London and here's some people to meet with. So I met with BBC and Channel 4 and ITV, all the major networks there. And so we're basically building a co-production structure to air Space Command as a
studio. Yeah, you've got your own studio, don't you?
Yes, I do. And I must tell you, it's a building full of spaceship sets. And when I stand on my spaceship sets, it's exactly the same feeling as when I was 10 years old on the Star Trek set.
That is amazing.
It's Christmas all over again.
And computer graphics have really changed the face of filmmaking now.
Yes, they have. It's phenomenal. And literally, you know, when I'm talking to my visual effects team, you know, and they're here and they're in Germany and they're all over the world, I can say, well, I want to put a monorail in here, or let's see how this looks. And it was very fun premiering. We have a great Space Command trailer. It's on my Mr. Sci-Fi site, or you can also go to marksicri.com and see it. And then when we premiered the opening 5 minutes, and the audience just went wild because it's this huge action sequence. And you can, there's no limits now to what you can show. It's just great fun. But the part of the fun of it is also, I grew up with the science fiction artists of the 50s and 60s. There's some great artists, and I use that as a little touchstone for our visual aesthetic. So there's a great science fiction artist named Ed Emshwiller, and I contacted his son, who's a friend of mine on Facebook, and I said, can we utilize some of his designs? So our ray gun for Space Command comes from a science fiction design he did back in the 50s, and so that's so much fun to be able to pay a tribute to these wonderfully talented writers and artists of that era.
Where does the future take films like this, Mark? What's next?
Well, you know, it's. I think, you know, man is the only animal that looked up at the sky and said, I wonder what's there, and then went there, you know? And I think that with what we're doing with Space Command and other wonderful science fiction films and TV shows and books that are being written now, things like The Martian, which was terrific.
Great movie. I love it.
Yeah, you can.
And by the way, they used our bumper music in a lot of segments there.
Yes, yes, yeah. Well, the thing is, you can really say, you know, it's possible for us to go out to, you know, colonize the solar system. It's possible for us to jump to the stars. They just found a planet that's the size of Earth in what's called the Goldilocks zone.
That's right.
In Proxima Centauri, you know, Proxima Centauri B. And that's only 4.5 light years away. So again, you know, with the advances in propulsion systems, that's not impossible within our lifetime to perhaps, you know, send somebody there. And so again, the universe is opening up to us, and I think it's very important that we go out there, not just our probes, but manned colonization of space. I think it's very important. And I think rather than turning inward and tearing ourselves apart through wars and all of the things happening now, we can look to the stars and really be the great species that we have the possibility of being.
I was just talking to one of our guests last night that I would not go to Mars one way. Would you?
No, I don't think so, but I'm really intrigued by Mars, and I really hope men do land there. I'm dying to find out what's in those caves and find out if there's life still somewhere on Mars. I think it'd be great if we found life.
Our special guest, Mark Zucri. We're going to take phone calls with Mark next hour. We're talking about the 50th anniversary of Star Trek and also some of Mark's works as well. And how did the Twilight Zone digital masters go for you?
It was great. It was great. I mean, it's really fun. Like, I produced the Blu-ray set, and to do 52 commentaries on all those episodes. Eventually, there's 104 episodes left. Eventually, I'll do commentaries on the remaining 104. I just haven't gotten around to it yet.
You'll get there.
Yeah.
You get there. There's no question about it. The original actors who were in Star Trek, I know, like, Leonard Nimoy went on to do In Search Of.
Yes.
And and Shatner did his thing. Did they all get nice jobs afterwards?
Well, they often tended to be typecast. It was difficult for some of the actors to get roles after Star Trek. But certainly in recent years, Shatner's done wonderfully, and George Takei has certainly gotten a thriving career. And I think talent will out. And then there's this fascinating thing of these Star Trek fan films where actors like Walter Koenig and Nichelle Nichols get to play their roles again, where you can see them, online in Star Trek episodes, where they get to play older versions of those characters, and that's really fun, and I'm glad that they have that outlet. Even though Paramount has started to crack down on some of those fan projects, which I don't agree with. I don't think they should, but it's these are very, very talented people, and whether you meet them in person at conventions or see their work from 50 years ago or from recently, they really have the chops. They're famous and beloved for a good reason. They've earned it.
And most of them are approachable, aren't they?
Yes, very much so. Very, very much so. George Takei is a great, wonderfully big-hearted man, they really appreciate their fans. They're very gracious, and I met Nichelle Nichols when I was a kid when Star Trek was on the air. A friend of mine who knew her said, "I've got a surprise for you." He was a friend of my mom's, and he drove me to her place, and I met her, and she gave me a signed Star Trek script. This is a her mimeograph, not Xerox. And I was a very smart 10-year-old, and I said, "Do you have any more of these?" And she reached in her waste paper basket and pulled out five more scripts. So five different episodes, all her scripts. So I have six original Star Trek scripts from when the show was on. These are some of my treasured possessions.
Mark, is Hollywood running out of ideas for new television shows and movies?
Not at all. There are 417 scripted comedy and drama series on the air right now on all different platforms and networks. And I think there's a wide variety, but the challenge is always quality, because the networks and the studios want to play it safe and just do retreads and remakes and all of that. What you have to find are those executives who will allow creative people to do something bold and something fresh. But that's why I did Space Command the way I've done it, because by reaching out to my audience, I was able to greenlight myself, and so I could write what I wanted to write. I could say what I wanted to say. I could cast who I wanted to cast. No one limited me in any way, shape, or form. So I think we as creators have a great opportunity now to interface with our audience and create amazing new shows. And I'm actually in conversations with a number of my friends who run network shows, where we're talking about collaborating on a lot of different new series that are going to come down the pike. There's a project I have now called Fugitive Space that I'm just starting to roll out, both as a movie and as a series of novels. I'm in talks with a lot of publishers at the moment on that, and studios as well. But there's a
exciting lot
of possibility.
All right, Mark, we're going to come back and take phone calls with you in our final hour on Coast to Coast AM.